This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
She hasn't been honest. If she was going to leave the Labour Party, she should have done it before the election. If she really had those problems, which were long-standing problems, she said, she shouldn't have stood as a Labour candidate, and we could have got somebody else, and we would have got a Labour person in that would have been a Labour MP in Canterbury, and it would not have been Rosie Duffield. She's trashed the Labour brand.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, Medway Council takes action to control the number of new HMOs, politicians clash as question time comes to Dover, and expelled reform councillors form a new group at County Hall. I'm Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway.
Hello.
And Dan Esson, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And Nikki White, who's been looking at what's happening at Westminster.
Hello.
This week's guest is Labour Kent County Councillor Connie Nolan, who represents Canterbury. Rob, what have you been looking at this week?
So we've talked previously about HMOs and the particular rise of them in Gillingham and efforts from various sides to try and combat them. Nushaba Khan, Gillingham and Raynham MP, wrote to Medway Council a couple of months ago asking them to consider introducing an Article 4 direction, which would give the council greater powers to prevent HMOs from cropping up. Well, now the authority is planning on introducing one as soon as possible following the agreement at its cabinet. What an Article 4 would actually do is mean HMOs for fewer than six occupants would be required to apply for planning permission, which they don't currently have to do. The hope is that this will mean, when these applications come in, the impact on parking and the provision of space for things like waste management will be determining factors, which could mean more are rejected. Issues around the pressure for parking, as well as littering and antisocial behaviour, have been raised as associated with the prevalence of HMOs in certain areas.
Yeah, you mentioned that the council plans to do this immediately. How soon is immediately?
Very immediately. The documents discuss two options. One is to give a year's notice for the change, and the other is to give no more than the standard notice period for any planning policy change, which is 21 days. Councillor Simon Curry said they had gone with a 21 days option because the need to do something is so urgent and they can't wait around. There is a possibility the quick turnaround could mean possible challenges around compensation for landlords adjusting to this change, but the authority doesn't believe this is a significant enough worry to outweigh the benefit of taking action sooner. This is just one of the tools the council has taken up lately, as it's also bringing in selective licensing rules to tackle poor quality housing and punish landlords who don't provide decent accommodation. The authority wanted to stress it's not against HMOs and they can provide a type of housing which people need, but because of the lack of a need for planning permission for this type of HMO, they can't keep track and ensure it's a decent standard and not impacting other residents.
Okay, thanks, Rob. We'll be returning to this a little bit later on. What have you been looking at then, Dan?
As per usual, I've had my nose deep in Canterbury planning problems, but not any specific development this time. Instead, I've been following attempts led by the City Council's Green Group to make the City Council impose something known as the Wealden Condition.
What's the Wealden Condition and how did that come about?
So it's been floating around the sort of planning world for a while now. It's so named because it's based on a rule implemented by Wealden District Council over in Sussex. It's a rule meaning that developers have to submit plans for how they would deal with sewage generated by developments for additional approval from a separate council body, and the upgrades to water infrastructure and to serve the needs of new development needs to be done before any actual building work takes place. At the end of October, Canterbury's full council voted unanimously to ask the cabinet to look into whether they could implement such a condition in the district, mainly because everyone in the district is quite unhappy with Southern Water about sewage being released into the sea and rivers in the area.
And what did the cabinet decide?
So at their meeting this week, they basically said that they can't do it. Legally, local planning authorities are technically separate from the council itself, and councils can't legally compel the planning committee to impose blanket conditions across all developments en masse. Everyone in the cabinet agrees that the situation with water infrastructure is terrible and pretty untenable, but have criticised the Greens for basically making a massive deal out of this motion as if it could have been some silver bullet. Instead, the cabinet is just going to await info from water companies about their future plans for infrastructure in the area. Needless to say, the Greens were not particularly pleased about this, accusing the council of a, quote, dereliction of duty, quote, end quote, and of not pursuing the possibility far enough.
So, Simon, what's been on your radar?
Well, three county councillors who were expelled by Reform UK have formed a new group. It's going to be made up of councillors Paul Thomas, Brian Black and Oliver Bradshaw, who all represent Maidstone divisions at KCC. And it's to be called the Independent Group, or TIG for short. So they're now known as TIGers, and will be led by Councillor Thomas, who incidentally ran for the leadership of the council against Lyndon Kemp-Caron and didn't get through. These guys were all booted out of Reform UK at the end of October for allegedly displaying a lack of integrity. And the expulsions come in the wake of that video of KCC leader Lyndon Kemp-Caron swearing and shouting at her members, and which was published in The Guardian. But all three members absolutely deny doing anything wrong. But since Reform swept into County Hall in May, they secured 57 of the 81 seats. Let's not forget, seven have been thrown out. One has defected to UKIP and another has been suspended pending criminal proceedings. The TIG will press for places on vital scrutiny committees, but are not believed to be aligned to any other of the opposition parties, the biggest which obviously at KCC is the Liberal Democrats. Two other members, Maxine Fothergill and Isabella Kemp, who were kind of widely expected to be possible members of this new group, haven't joined, and I haven't managed to get hold of them to ask what their plans might be. And this follows on from the formation of another independent group, the Independent Reformers, which is comprised of Bill Barrett and Robert Ford, who were also thrown out. They were kicked out by email, which claimed that they had undermined the party's interests and brought Reform into disrepute. But again, both men deny any wrongdoing.
So is this significant?
Well, it is in a way. I mean, should any other disgruntled members of any party, including Reform UK, decide that they need a new home, then there are two alternatives. It also points to what happens when you get 57 out of 81 seats. Many of those were not expected to win, and when they were thrown together, they hardly knew each other. So there were bound to be a few who either would leave by natural wastage, but in this case, nine have gone, and the leader will have to lose an awful lot more if they're to have anything like a shaky majority. Nikki, what's been catching your eye this week?
Our journalist colleagues at the BBC brought Question Time to Dover with an immigration special, and Dover MP Mike Tapp, who is also the migration minister, he was one of those on the panel.
I bet there was a bit of a lively debate at that one.
Yeah, there was. It's a subject which raises passions, and certainly very few people, if anybody at the moment, feels we have a system in place which actually works. So there were lots of differing opinions on what our asylum system should look like. But what did upset Mr. Tapp was a throwaway comment from Reform's head of policy, Zia Yusuf, who was also on the panel as well.
Yeah, I watched it, but just for those who didn't, what actually happened?
So there was a discussion going on about whether or not cutting migration might harm our public services. And as is normal, one member of the audience challenged a comment by Reform's head of policy, Zia Yusuf, who had said there were many British doctors and nurses struggling to get jobs because the system has been, he says, overwhelmed by foreign nationals. Now, the man in the audience also said that Mike Tapp's comment that waiting lists in the services were due to migration was a fallacy. So he picked up points with both of them. But the upset came when the man who said he'd joined the NHS as a student in the 70s, he asked Mr. Yusuf to clarify a point over workers losing their indefinite leave to remain. Now, he said he'd understood that what Mr. Yusuf was saying was if someone had worked in the care sector for decades, they would then be sent back to where they came from when they reached pensionable age. Now, Mr. Yusuf said no, that wasn't what he was saying, which was fair enough. But he then told the member of the public, and I quote, if you'd paid attention to what we were announcing, you would not have that view.
Yeah, that didn't go down very well with the audience, as I recall. You know, perhaps a bit harsh.
Yeah, I mean, for politicians debating with each other, probably not. But to make that comment to a member of the public who was simply asking a question, well, like you said, it drew a huge gasp from the audience. Now, Mr. Tapp was quick to come to the defence of the audience member, telling Mr. Yusuf he should be more polite. And Mr. Tapp reiterated that in a column he wrote for Kent Online this week when he said that Mr. Yusuf had disrespected Doverians. He said that it's in such a polarising time, it was important to have disagreement and debate, but you should do so politely. And he felt that Mr. Yusuf's actions had been crass, unnecessarily, and deeply condescending. Now, one thing Mr. Tapp did say, he said that one thing he genuinely appreciates about his constituency is that he can walk down the high street or pop into the pub, and even the people that he meets who disagree with him, they have conversations about these sort of matters, but they still remain polite and respectful to each other. And he said politics can be turbulent and tensions can run high, but there's never an excuse for arrogance and rudeness.
Okay, thank you very much, Nikki.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Our guest this week is one of only two Labour county councillors who survived the Great Reform UK invasion of County Hall in May. Connie Nolan and her colleague Alistair Brady have nevertheless done their utmost to be heard against all the din at a time of great upheaval in local government, and she's here today. Welcome, Connie.
Oh, thank you for having me, Simon.
You're not new to local politics by any stretch of the imagination, and but you are new to County Hall. Were you surprised at how well Reform UK did in May?
I think Reform UK were surprised how much they did as well. There were councillors turning up who looked like rabbits in the headlamps, and I did actually feel sorry for them.
You felt sorry for a Reform?
Yeah. No, seriously. On a personal level, I thought, my goodness, they didn't expect this at all.
Well, sure, it was widely said that no one, even the Reform guys themselves, didn't really think that they would get even enough for a majority, much less sort of get sort of 16 more than what was required of to get a majority. So there must be a fair few in there who perhaps didn't think they were going to get elected.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things about KCC at the moment is because they're running with people who are competent and people who aren't really sure why they're there.
Mm. Who are you talking about specifically?
I'm talking about individuals. But we have people who think they're still down the dog and duck and make comments which were totally outrageous. And Alistair and I call them all out.
But, the actual result in May, I mean, that's really just a reflection of the mood of the country. It's a rejection of Labour and the Conservatives in favour of something, seen as new and radical. And that's not just Reform, that's the Green Party too.
Yeah, Simon, absolutely. I mean, on the doorsteps in 2023, 2024, and again in 2025, I saw the way it was going. People wanted to get rid of Johnson's government. They wanted to get rid of Sunak, which they saw a continuation. And that gave impetus to Labour. They weren't Labour voters. They lent us their vote. And then suddenly, they don't get what they think they were going to get. And they turn to Reform. Very persuasive. Reform's very persuasive.
But where did it go wrong where and why did it go wrong for Labour, do you think, in your view, personal view?
Well, this is my personal view. I think it went wrong as soon as people thought we had a magic bullet, which obviously no government would have. And I can remember going to the Labour conference last year and saying to fellow delegates, where's the hope? We need to give people hope. And not false hope, which is what I think Reform are giving people, but actually saying, this is a pretty awful time, but we can get through it. And there wasn't that,
So you're saying essentially this was a bit of a communication problem.
I think so, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But we have to remember that Starmer was voted for, not because he's got charisma, because he hasn't, let's be honest, but because he was calm, the adult in the room.
Yes, I think you're right. I think people were just after the sort of the chaos of the post-pandemic, the pandemic and the pandemic years, people were just crying out for Mr. Boring. They just wanted somebody, a grown-up in the room, didn't they?
Exactly. They wanted the adult in the room. And that is what Starmer is. But the thing is, people are not happy with their lives and they're not seeing things change quickly enough. And so they're looking around for another person to come. But you know what? Reform are on the way down. It's the green surging at the moment. And I think we're going to get this up and down until people can see that their life is improving under a Labour government. Steady the buffs, as we say in Canterbury.
So we've mentioned, obviously, that you and Alistair Brady are the only two Labour members left in the county council. Do you think, sort of long term and politically, surely it's quite a bad sign that Labour, the ostensible party of the working class, that in Kent the only two seats it's able to get are in the county's only university town and probably the most middle class place in the east of the county?
Oh, come to Barton Ward for me. It's huge. We've got a lot of working class people. And we've got a lot of middle class people, yes. And I worked at Christchurch for 20 years and students are the most fickle people you can come across. Yes, they'll say, yes, we'll put a poster in the window. I go and knock on Poland and they've gone. So, you can't say it's just because it's a university town. But Canterbury is special. Absolutely. I love Canterbury. I love Canterbury people. And they open up their hearts and they're absolutely brilliant people. But there's working class people and they're very much concentrating in certain areas. And I go to those areas. They know me very much. It's personality politics at the moment. And I think that's what carried Alistair and me through, Dan.
Just Just can I ask you a little bit about your sort of your own sort of your life, where you came from,
and
how you became a member of the Labour Party, and what your journey was into to politics?
Okay, so going back to when I was 16 and living in Woolwich, I used to deliver leaflets for the Labour Party, because I felt very much part of the working class community and really had Labour values right from the get go. Growing up, fell in love and came out to Kent and found the same kind of values where I was. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm, you know, it's a bit like a football team. You've got to stick with it when they're winning and when they're not winning. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, you believe in that particular football team. You believe in that. I believe in the Labour Party. And it will come through, but it's going to be hard.
Would you describe yourself as a socialist?
Oh, gosh, yes. Absolutely. Mm.
So how did you feel about the new Labour era? That wasn't very socialist.
The
new Labour era, Blair and the like. I mean, he wasn't a socialist.
No, he certainly wasn't. But he got things done, and that's important. Mm. And I think at the end of the day, you've got to look at getting things done. I didn't agree with a lot of stuff he did, and I think some of the legacy that's is awful, but we got things done. Sure Start was the most brilliant thing that a Labour government did, and I think, you know, that's really important. Setting up apprenticeships are coming back, which is brilliant. We've got to have faith in our young people. They're going to take us through. It's really important. And the other thing is that we don't see everything as a market. You know, the markets are important. Yes, absolutely they are. But the national health is not a market. We've got to really fight for that. We've got to really fight for our schools and our colleges and our university, because that's the future. Absolutely the future.
So from 2017 to 2024, there was only one Labour MP in Kent, and it was Rosie Duffield, Labour MP for Canterbury. Obviously, she's since... I say defected, but more left the Labour Party because she hasn't joined another one. I had it on reasonably good authority that the party's relationship with Rosie Duffield was quite fractious throughout her time as an MP, owing at least in part to her very strident position and emphasis on issues of gender politics and gender identity. What did you make of her performance as an MP and then her later sort of leaving the party?
Well, Simon, I was one of the people that went out and really campaigned for Rosie, because I was campaigning for the Labour Party. I was there in Westgate Hall when she won. I was one of the people that had to go into the ladies' toilets and get her out, because she never expected to win. We didn't think she was going to win. And I think it's, again, the situation that she was a rabbit in headlamps. I think had we really expected that Labour would win, Rosie wouldn't have been our candidate.
I mean, what was it that made her get selected then, you think? Was she a sort of stalwart of, you know, committee navigator of the local party who just did very well at selection?
Chair of the local party. Yeah, absolutely.
I see.
Yeah, but once she was elected, we got behind her. Absolutely got behind her. And I can remember her walking into Dane John, you know, it was the Pride and everybody was cheering and it was marvellous. Canterbury had a Labour MP. And that's what people wanted, a Labour MP, not someone who wanted to make their own mind up about things.
Yeah. Do you feel let down by Rosie?
Absolutely, yes.
In what way?
Well, because she hasn't been honest. If she was going to leave the Labour Party, she should have done it before the election. If she really had those problems, which were long-standing problems, she said, she shouldn't have stood as a Labour candidate, and we could have got somebody else, and we would have got a Labour person in that would have been a Labour MP in Canterbury, and it would not have been Rosie Duffield.
Right. And if she stands again this time, not on a Labour ticket, but as a sort of independent socialist or independent Labour type, do you think she would win?
No.
Why not?
She hasn't got the following. She hasn't got the people who will go out, like me, who go out and wear out two pairs of trainers going up and down the street leafleting. She wouldn't win.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm not sure that a Labour candidate would win because she's trashed the Labour brand.
Yeah.
But well, I mean, surely if the Labour Party don't win the next election in Canterbury, it's going to be, like you say, Rosie Duffield doesn't have a particularly strong local following, but nor does she have a particularly strong contingent of of local opposition. Surely if Labour loses the next Canterbury, the next general election, you can't just say, oh, it's because of Rosie.
No, it isn't just because of Rosie. No, what I mean to say is I don't think Labour will win in Canterbury unless we get a very strong unless the government is actually doing much better, because I think local people will say, we'll try somebody else.
And speaking of, obviously you say, yeah, Canterbury's a uni town. The students are quite electorally fickle if they participate at all.
But no, they do also participate, Dan. We know they do participate. What I'm saying is you can't always trust them to turn up in big numbers.
So, for example, I remember I was a student at the University of Kent in 2019, and the political sort of mobilisation on campus in support of particularly Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party was massive. And all of my friends who were academics said to me that they had never seen that level of political activity on campus before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now there is, you know, chaotic as it may be, there is an organisation which can try to lay claim to that energy. Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana have Your Party. There is competing for a very similar space. There is Zach Polanski's Green, which also positions itself on the sort of new left populist kind of wing of things. Do you think that there's a risk of either of those parties either eating into Labour's vote or straight up taking Canterbury next time?
It's already, the Green Party has already eaten to the Labour Party group. Absolutely, it has. I mean, when I was knocking on doors and people were knocking on doors with me, they would say, no, we're not going to vote Labour. And then they'd say, oh, it's Connie. I'll vote for Connie. And that's what I mean. It's personality politics at the moment.
And do you think the Greens have quite a strong ground game in Canterbury? Because obviously they've taken a couple of seats in by-elections of late as well.
I think they're very strong. Yeah.
And what about, like I say, obviously it's been widely regarded as quite a mess in the few months since it's been trying to get established. But there is now Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana's Your Party does exist. Do you think that has a chance of getting much purchase in Canterbury?
I really don't know. I haven't been out knocking on doors, but in the new year, I will be talking with people and finding out exactly where the ground lays. I know that there were streets in Barton Ward, which used to be Labour, and now they're Green.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, the Kent Council's wish list for local government reform went to the minister at the end of November. Which option, if any, did you favour?
Okay, we're going for 4D. Uh-huh. And it's the one which is the, you know, sort of the cutting up Faversham. I'm not sure about that personally, but the idea is that it makes Whitstable, Canterbury, Ramsgate, Dover, Folkestone together, which works really well. I would have liked to see Ashford.
Yeah, sort of east.
Yeah.
East.
Yeah. I would like to have seen Ashford in, part of Ashford in that. So if you take a line down Hythe through to Faversham and up, I would have liked to have seen that. But anyway, it is what it is. So
3A seems to be the one that is most in favour or has the most consensus.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean to say that's the best one.
Yeah. Okay.
3A, you've got more in the East Kent bit, because you've got Ashford and Tenton, Hythe and Folkestone. But it's big. It's very big.
It is huge, isn't it?
Huge, absolutely huge.
I mean, do you... This is obviously the government's doing it for all sorts of different reasons, for streamlining the way local government is done, to create those, you know, cut the two tiers, make it more efficient, save money, all the rest of it. But do you believe that local government needs that overhaul?
I think it needs something. It definitely needs an overhaul. But exactly what it's going to look like, I don't know. Let's wait and see what happens. Once it happens, I'll get behind it and I'll make sure that it works to the best of my ability.
Earlier on, Connie, you mentioned sort of supporting, being a long-time member of the Labour Party and supporting them is something like supporting a football team. It's kind of long-term. You know, it's a long-term part. It's a big part of your life. It's a big part of in political culture, what it means to be into politics. But Labour in the election in 2024, if you go by both registered voters and the actual population who could register but didn't, was elected on the lowest proportion of the adult public of any government ever elected since universal suffrage in this country. The polls have been, you know, pretty much rock bottom consistently. There is a a clear and relatively popular insurgent party of the populist right, which stands a good chance of winning next general election. And it's well known that Labour now guards its membership figures jealously because they've plummeted so catastrophically mm-hmm. since back when people used to breathlessly say it was now a mass party because it had 500,000 members under Corbyn. Do you really think the Labour Party will still be a relevant force for government and politics in this country in, say, 15 years?
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You were talking earlier about the numbers that were sort of behind Corbyn. I can remember walking down the street with a Labour Visi vest on and people were singing to me, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn." You know, he took the imagination and he's, you know, for whatever you want to say, people got behind him. And they felt that he was someone who listened. And but that will happen again.
He also led Labour to a really, really catastrophic defeat, which has ruined the internal culture of Labour as well as probably the chances of what you might consider a more left-wing government in this country.
So you have to say, you know, charismatic leader has to have people around him who know how to actually use the system. And he didn't. And that's just it at the end of the day. You said yourself, you know, with the lowest turnout, the Labour government got the biggest majority. So that just proves it's the way that the system actually works. Does it need reform? Possibly. I don't know.
I say, surely it's not a good thing if a party which is objectively very unpopular can still claim majority government. I mean, you see it. There's a pretty widespread sense, I think, that the Labour Party does not have what you would consider to be democratic legitimacy. You know, back when Attlee was elected or something, a solid majority of people voted and voted for the Labour Party. Now it's not the case. Surely it's not a good thing if the goal is to just preserve a system that can maintain a popular, which doesn't have any real mooring in society.
Well, let's see what happens over the next 2 years. I think we can stabilise, win back the trust. And the thing is, people lost trust during COVID. There was all sorts of social upset. And then the press was showing us how the government that was telling us what to do was doing something completely different. So there's a lack of trust, absolute lack of trust in politicians. And I think one of the things we need to do is build back that trust, absolutely build back. And how are we going to do that? We've got to over deliver and under promise. But that looks a bit boring. That's the problem.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, the apprenticeships is such a great opportunity. And it's been wasted as a media opportunity to talk about things. People are talking about everything else, but not this apprenticeship scheme.
That's because it's an idea and it hasn't actually been rolled out yet. And that's part of the problem. You've got to deliver on these things before you start announcing
absolutely.
Them, which is probably what you just said.
Yeah, and 15 million isn't going to touch the sides, but it's the start. It's really the start.
Just finally, is there any way that you or your party might contemplate a reform of the voting system in terms of Westminster elections, i.e. you know, getting rid of the first past the post and replacing it with some form of PR?
I don't know. I honestly don't know which way the wind's blowing on that one. But at the moment, they're saying no.
Okay. Colin Nolan, thank you very much indeed for your time today.
You're very welcome.
One of the major issues to face Kent communities in recent years is the apparent rise of HMOs, houses of multiple occupancy. Certainly people are talking about HMOs a lot, but surely, you know, people have been living in HMOs for decades. Do you, Rob, do you see this as a problem?
No, I don't really. I mean, for full clarity, I live in an HMO because it's a very convenient place for me to live as sort of a young professional who does not have the deposit to buy a house or that sort of thing. HMOs are incredibly convenient for sort of people in my situation because they give an ease of, you know, if I need to move somewhere else, I can very easily. And for example, I do know people who have lived in sort of a more typical flat share or house share situation where basically one of the, say it's a 4-bed house and one of them moves out, they need to find somebody else to replace them in that, that room. Otherwise their costs go up and their rent goes up. Whereas in the situation I'm in, over the summer, I live in a 5-bed HMO and three of the rooms weren't occupied, but my rent stayed the same level. And so HMOs, I see a lot of people complain about them, and I totally understand why some people might have concerns about, you know, loads of HMOs coming up. But really, it's not that much different from if it was just a house share. You know, yes, there are pressures around parking and stuff, but, you know, in lots of residential streets, there's problems around parking because now, you know, 50 years ago, cars weren't as common as they are today. And now you'll have families with three or four cars. So I understand why HMOs can be annoying. I can understand why neighbours can be annoying. And particularly, you know, a lot of people, there's a sort of characterisation of people who live in HMOs as a particular kind of person that bring a particular set of problems. I don't think that's unique to HMOs. I think it's just that HMOs give a good name to, you know, rather than saying, oh, this new house share is going to come into our area, you say an HMO or not, that conjures up these ideas to people. And that's why we see the opposition to it. Whereas actually, if you said to people, we need somewhere who, for people who, you know, might move away for whatever reason or can't afford to buy a house, most people would say, yeah, we do need something like that as well.
Okay, but what makes HMOs attractive to the people who own the houses? That seems to be because people are applying for HMO status for certain types of properties. What are the benefits for the property owners?
Well, I think it's, I suppose it's easier if you're a renter to move into an HMO than right. It is to a, you know, lots of people will know that if you're at university, you might have a group of friends and they'll move into a house together and they'll rent the whole house. Whereas, you know, I moved here and I didn't know anyone from Medway, where I now live. And so that's kind of not really a practical option for me. I don't, you know, I can't just be like, oh, I'll just ring up my six friends in Medway and we'll rent this house together. I need one room. So from the landlord side, if you say, okay, I've got this one block that people have to rent together and it makes it more difficult. Whereas if you break it up into little rooms, yeah, you might have one that's empty for a little while, but you're more likely to get people moving in, I think.
Yeah, a bit more flexibility. But what sort of rights do you have? Do you have more same rights as any other tenant or is things slightly different?
I believe so. I mean, I haven't really looked into it. I've not had that many problems in terms of issues with my tenancy, to be honest. But I think it's basically the same as a normal renter would be.
I think the main flexibility is being able to move out earlier if you rent it by the room. Whereas like, if you're in a fixed tenancy and you rent a whole house to yourself, it's basically like if you vacate the premises before your tenancy ends and you have to end it, you can apply to end it, but there can be additional costs. Whereas if you're renting by the room in a big house, usually it's, you can get ones which are like month to month rolling, basically.
But does it also mean that the property owner can get rid of tenants or people living there more easily?
I think it's the same because, well, particularly now where they're bringing in the Renters Reform Bill, which the default will be that you get a rolling contract. For example, I'm currently live on a year tenancy and there's a breakout clause where if I live there for 6 months after that point, I can say, right, I'd like to give my 2 months notice and leave. It's the same way the landlord can say, yeah, you've got 2 months to move out. Whereas the rolling contract that the Renters Reform Bill will bring in is after that 1 year, then I can hand in a 2 months notice at any point. Whereas at the moment, so I moved in August, I re-sign a contract basically. So that signs me up for another 6 months where I have to live there and then have a breakout clause after that point.
Yeah, because when I moved to England, I lived in a sort of a house with, I think, five or six different rooms. And we each paid for the room and then we played a sort of split of the electricity and the rates basically. So we presumably that was effectively an HMO.
Yeah.
Well, that was nearly 40 years ago. So they've been around for a while, haven't they? You've got some experience of HMOs as well, haven't you, from your early days?
Yeah, a little bit. Like you say, they've been around for a long time, whether it's, lots of people stopped in B&Bs back in the old day, didn't they? But I stayed in an HMO. I've been in a couple. I mean, there's always been a demand. I lived in one in Portsmouth when I was a student and two different ones when I first started out as a cub reporter. I mean, back then you had to live on the patch that you worked. And my first job was in Folkestone. And there was no way that I could have afforded to have rented a place on my own. So shared accommodation was the only option for me. Now, this was at a time we're going back all these years went to when the Channel Tunnel was being built. And I think I was in a house with six others. I say think because despite a shared kitchen, the only other person I used to see was a teacher. Never saw anybody else. And the only evidence I saw of these people, the others were tunnel workers. So they worked different shifts to me. They were obviously sometimes doing night shifts and weekend shifts. And the only evidence I ever saw of their existence was brick and cement dust in the shower plug hole, which wasn't very pleasant. But, you know, there was no noise. There was nothing like that. But that's the only reason I knew there were other people in the house. But I was happy there. I could afford it, but I could still shut a locked door on my one room little kingdom. I mean, you know, bringing in extra legislation, I mean, does it need it? probably because the way the housing market is going, the demand for these places is only going to increase. But the one thing I do take people's point is about saying these places do nothing to help create community spirit. You know, from what Rob has said, it sounds as if he knows his fellow tenants quite well. But my entire stay in an HMO, I only ever met one other person. And I certainly didn't meet any of my neighbours in the houses in other streets because I was either at work or I was covering various council meetings, particularly parish council meetings that went on late into the night, or I was travelling home at weekends to see my family. Now, I want to echo what Rob has said. I mean, I think there's a lot of emphasis being placed on the so-called bad people who might move into these properties. And I think this is why, you know, people are getting so obsessed about what should be happening with them. You know, but criminals own property too. They don't all live in HMOs. So that, and any legislation that the authorities can bring in, that's not going to change that at all. It's not going to change the kind of people that are coming in to rent this thing. And I think generally the people that do use HMOs are professional people. They are people who are, they're just lovely neighbours like you would hope and expect, whether they bought it or whether they were renting it. But keeping an eye on the numbers, they are going to go up, and keeping an eye on the numbers being developed in one particular area, I think that's an important thing. You want to be able to keep an essence of a community. So I think looking at the legislation is going to be a good thing.
Yes, but I guess at the same time, it does create a transient population, especially if you've got a high volume of HMOs, which will alter communities.
It will do, but if that's what the demand is for, then you've got to provide it, you know, because where are these people going to live? Rob will have to come and stay in your shed.
Yeah. There's loads of HMOs in Maidstone already, so maybe Simon can expand his business repertoire. I think there's something to be said that a lot of the problems people have with HMOs are basically downstream of other social problems or things which they take issue with in general, immigration, crime and so on. And the I've lived in technically HMOs, but it's always been me and a group of friends renting a whole house. Whereas I think the ones which people tend to have more of an issue with stereotypically is large, you know, four floor Georgian terraces or whatever, broken up into multiple small flats rented by the room, like the one Rob lives in, not to cast aspersions on your neighbourliness. But the relative flexibility of contract and the fact that, you know, despite the fact rent is punitively high in general, it's marginally cheaper than renting, for example, a studio flat for yourself. That does tend to create, like you say, a transient population. And disproportionately with, you know, extremely high immigration to Britain over the past few years, disproportionately HMOs do tend to, you know, people who are recent immigrants to the country often tend to live in them. But I think it's a very small factor in other problems which people generally perceive. And even if HMOs were made illegal tomorrow, that wouldn't change the fact that that crime and immigration exist.
Well, I mean,
the housing situation.
Yeah, the one I lived in, I mean, nobody in that house came from London. I mean, we all lived in London, and I didn't come from London, and nor did any of my. We still became very good friends, and we were together for probably the better part of 3 years together. We did feel part of the community that we lived in. I happened to live on the patch that I was a reporter on, and then I commuted into London, but that's what everyone was doing. So it was that's how it was, really.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing to say is that it's a good way of keeping old properties in use. I mean, there's lots of large old properties that people can't afford to run on their own as a family anymore. So keeping, you know, having somebody come in and provide homes for more people and keep that property in good order, surely that's a good thing.
Certainly in London back in the 1980s, there was lots and lots and lots of very derelict, very badly looked after properties, which were just left to rack and ruin. Those things in some of the places that they were located in, places like Brixton or Stockwell, we are in the worth an absolute fortune, but they weren't then. I mean, you can give them away. That was a different time, and suppose everything evolves in its own way. Okay, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Dan and Robert for their contributions, and to our special guest this week, Connie Nolan. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can also sign up for our politics newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.